Joining us today is Matt Rubiner, owner and operator of Rubiner's Cheesemongers and Grocers in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, my hometown. But the journey to owning his own cheese shop has had many twists and turns, including work as a defense analyst. We'll talk with Matt Rubiner about all of that and much more. But first, welcome, Matt.
Thank you.
Okay, so Matt, you're sort of from Michigan or something, some strange place like that?
I'm very much from Michigan.
What kind of place is Michigan? It's boring, isn't it?
No. I imagine it has boring patches. It's a beautiful state.
Yeah?
Really? I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit, which I don't characterize as beautiful, but very, very suburban. But if you go up in the north of the state, it's gorgeous.
Let's get it right off the table. Your parents were well-heeled, right?
I wouldn't say well-heeled. Healed.
Okay, they were healed. What did they what did they do?
My dad was and remains a lawyer.
Siblings?
I got three sisters, which is what made me so extraordinarily sensitive to women's problems. I have an older sister who's in California. She's an editor. I have a younger sister in Northampton who's also an editor and a writer, and a younger sister still who's a voiceover actress in California.
Now, everybody who knows you knows you're a fairly bright guy.
No,
you are. So why don't you, with a wicked wit, you know, I saw a bio of you in which you said nothing important happened while I was, you know, in my primary and secondary
years. An unremarkable childhood.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I thought I was a standard, you know, suburban kid, I think. You know,
play sports, did you?
No, I did with friends, but
played
I was
cheese?
Never...
Did you play cheese?
Didn't play cheese. I played sports with friends. I wasn't a gifted athlete, though I wasn't a total klutz. And I was your standard model kind of gentleman's B student through, you know, most of school and active in, well, active's a strong word, but, you know, choir and the school plays and things like that. And, yeah, pretty dull.
Did your parents encourage you to achieve more than they thought you were achieving as a gentlemanly bee?
They certainly encouraged it.
Mm-hmm.
Whether I took them up on that encouragement. No, I did. I did fine. I was always the, if you really applied yourself, imagine what you could become.
Mm. Well, we're very proud of you in Great Barrington, but we'll go forward. And then you went to college.
Went to college, to the University of Michigan. We're very much a University of Michigan family.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's a state university.
Yes, that's a state university. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in my family, you were all but destined to go to the University of Michigan. Or the directive was, you pay for it yourself. But I always wanted to go to the University of Michigan. I'm something of a rabid fan of University of Michigan sports to this day. As my wife will tell you, the first thing I do in the morning is read the Detroit Free Press sports page, you know, online, which I've never been able to get away from. And then I was there for a number of years. I studied abroad for a bit and got a bachelor's degree I was in a program in Michigan called the Residential College, sort of this school within a school program where, you know, you didn't get grades and you went to class in your pajamas and you could make up your own major. And I did a major in military history, which was an interest of mine as a kid.
That's interesting that you chose military history in a clearly foo-foo setting. You know, in other words... You know, you make up your own grades, you wear pajamas, and you chose military history. Now, there's a little something different.
I did.
What made you choose military history?
I think it was something I've been interested in my whole life. You know, as a kid, I'd go to the library and take out Admiral Morrison's, you know, multi-volume history of the Pacific War.
But of course. Von Clausewitz and things like that.
Yeah. And read my Clausewitz, had Clausewitz by the bed. And it was just something I was interested in political science. I have to admit that although I think I've softened over the years, I wasn't quite as deeply to the left as perhaps most of my classmates at the residential college. So perhaps there was something of a reaction to study a more traditional, you know, aspect of political science and military history than...
But you've always taken a path different from others. I mean, that's sort of part of your...
I never really thought
not
of
every,
myself
not
that
every,
way.
Not every Jewish kid, I presume, Jewish kid from Michigan...
Why do you presume?
From Michigan. from Michigan. chooses cheesemongering.
That's so, true, yeah.
So then what happened?
Well, there was quite a span between University of Michigan military history and cheesemongering.
No, I know.
Although, as I noted in my detailed biography I gave you, my mother claims that, you know, as a youth I declared that I would someday open a cheese shop and I don't really have any independent verification of that, but that's what she says. But I do know that I did attempt on several Hanukkahs of my youth to order cheese and meat gift baskets from the Sears catalog for my Hanukkah presents.
It's highly illegal.
And I was told no.
Yeah.
No, I got a football and some Dr. Denton's. But after college, I studied abroad and I studied in Japan. Japan was a real focus of mine.
Did you learn any Japanese?
Yeah, absolutely.
You're fluent in Japanese?
No, I would say I'm formally fairly proficient now, a bit rusty, no chance to use it other than pound okay, ma'am, or who's next?
But if you wanted to go into, this is what I've always wanted to do, to a really good sushi place where, you know, the guys are in Japanese and you come in and sit down there and they say something about you in Japanese, you'd be able to call them on it.
Oh, indeed.
Mm-hmm. This is very
Although our local sushi place, the sushi chef's just another ornery old Jewish guy. So what's he going to say about me?
Well, I would say that's your opinion. It may be true.
But we speak Japanese together, actually.
He speaks Japanese. That's
right. He does.
Okay. So then you went into the military business, didn't you?
Sort of, yeah. I was in Japan for a couple of years, and then I was in Tokyo and Yokohama as part of an exchange that the Japanese Foreign Ministry sponsored. Not really an exchange, but a cultural program. Placing Americans, British, Australians in Japanese municipal offices, really just to, help them. The buzzword was internationalization and, but it was really just to have an English-speaking presence, somebody to give that international face to these offices.
Well, what would you do? I mean, give us a...
I'd do nothing.
You just did nothing.
No, we would plan conferences. I would, greet people at the airport. I would be called upon to give sort of cultural talks and things and, tell tales of America. And it wasn't terribly substantive.
What would you tell them about America? That would...
Who remembers?
You don't even remember.
Who remembers?
Okay.
But after that, I wanted to figure out a way to pursue professionally this interest in military history, military studies in Japan. So I came back to the United States, and I came back for something of a golden time for that trade. The Soviet Union was, just about to fall apart, and which meant that much of the funding that had been dedicated to that sort of research on the Soviet Union, traditional kind of Cold War military research, was freeing up, and the U.S. seemed very interested in finding newer enemies, newer ways to focus their money. So there seemed to be an interest in Asia, and Japan was our great economic nemesis, at the time. And so I took a job. I was able to find a job. I interviewed on the Hill, and I interviewed in different offices in the State Department and so forth. And I found a job at a defense contractor in Virginia that was doing precisely that, studying Asian military and military technology.
Do the Prius drivers in Great Barrington know all of this?
Don't get me started on Priuses. I was recently at a wedding last week in Big Sur, and I wrecked my rental Prius. So
I drive one.
I know you do.
I love it.
I know.
But okay, so I'm just wondering whether, all our colleagues understand that you were once in the
defense
industry.
We can't be blamed
industry.
For our former lives, and I've reformed. I've given my life to something better, more noble. So if folks
some
will
of these
forgive
people,
me
some
my
of these
past.
Folks can be very unforgiving.
Yeah, it's
Matthew.
True.
Okay. All right. let the record show he just made a face. Okay. So now what happened then?
All right. So I worked.
Were you doing there?
I was in a very, very junior capacity. It was the things that the division of this company.
How junior? Like coffee?
Well, actually,
and cheese.
This was, well, interesting you say that. Not cheese. But one of my duties, and this was one of my most cherished duties, not the most substantive, but. I was tasked with getting the coffee for the office, not like fetching a cup, but actually procuring the coffee. But my boss, very enlightened, was interested in something better. Where what's happening in coffee? And so I would scour the country and read books and find roasters. And this is well before the
How old were you at this point?
Yeah, I was 23. 2005-ish. Mm-hmm. So I started bringing coffee in from all over the country, and soon our little division in this company in Virginia
had a lot of visitors.
We had a lot of visitors, and then, you know, we're talking, you know, military brass and undersecretaries of this and that would come in, and they would come to our office because the coffee was so damn good. Uh-huh. Anyway. That was one of my jobs. The other one was...
Did the taxpayers pay for this?
The coffee... Ultimately, it could be traced back to the taxpayer, sure. they pay for worse. So my other jobs were I was a rapporteur, which meant I was the guy taking notes at meetings.
Oh, I thought that meant you had birds on your shoulder.
No. So, I don't know what that means.
Raptors.
I see.
Go ahead.
And so we would do... One of the activities was what we call, I guess what they were, war games, you know, kind of political economic modeling games. And I would kind of take notes on that and help out. Another one of my jobs was we did assessments of Japanese and Chinese military technology capabilities in very discrete areas of science. And I would... interact with, you know, whoever the investigator we hired to do the report and edit the reports, and, you know, pretty dull stuff.
Wow. Did you have any inkling, because I don't think anybody else in this country did, that communism was over and that the wall was coming down and all of that?
Well, you know, we saw it very quickly when whole divisions of the company would just disappear overnight. You know, there was a big division, 40, 50 person division, and in the company, and then one day we came to work and they were packing up their desks, and, you know, it seemed that they had stopped all further research in intermediate range, you know, ballistic missiles, and so these, their reason for being ceased. And so we saw it that way, you know, we saw it from a budgetary perspective. But, you know, I was in that business when that was falling apart, but we were able to present to the various government customers that, oh, you know, whoa, your Cold War in Europe's ending, but we still got a great one going in Asia,
sure.
So you should fund this project and that project. So
we're talking to Master, you may not know it, but we're talking to Master Cheesemonger.
Is this what I'm here to talk about?
Right. Matthew Rubiner, and we'll be talking about that soon. But in order to understand the ingredients in the cheese, you better understand who you're talking to, who's laying hands on your cheese, and who is cutting it. So
how deep are we into the interview before you got that out?
So, right.
As it were.
So now, what happened then?
So I did that for a couple of years. And one of the things when you do these war games, you hire a bunch of very smart people from the military and professors at universities and think tanks to assemble, you know, at some undisclosed location in the Virginia countryside and get together and do these games, and you just meet a lot of people. And I met a professor at MIT who was very interested in doing this sort of work and thought he could get grant funding to do it. And so I eventually moved to Cambridge to work in his program in the political science department at MIT, essentially doing the same sort of work.
When did you meet your very beautiful and lovely wife?
Well, I met her in or around August of 96, briefly. She was introduced to me by a friend, and the first thing she ever said to me was, "This is the cheese boy," which is a...
Oh, so you were already into cheese by that time.
Oh, yeah, I was into cheese. And cheese boy was my nickname around town, which I didn't do anything to suppress because, you know, people didn't need to know my name. They knew me as cheese boy.
And what town was this now?
This is Boston, Cambridge. Yeah. And she had heard about me, and my friend kept referring to me as the cheese boy. She thought I was like a big Dutch guy.
Now, what did you get? I'm sorry, I missed this.
That was a bit of a skip.
Where did you get them? How did you get into cheese?
Well, so I went to MIT.
You were working at MIT.
Yes, I was working at MIT. And this is the...
You were boating on the Charles, but working at MIT.
It's funny you say that because...
Yes, you were.
Well, you were able to check out a sailboat anytime you liked.
Sure. I actually went with a friend.
Oh, yeah.
So I know. Yeah.
Don't tell my former employers that those meetings were... And I was there for a couple of years. And then it was just time for the next step. You know, I didn't really see myself doing what it would take to become senior in my field. You know, I wasn't ever going to be some high-ranking military officer. If you ever want to go get a PhD, you know, go work in a PhD program for a couple of years and see how hard those people work.
You mean that you don't think they do?
No, I think they work incredibly hard. And I just couldn't, you know, it occurred to me that I'm just not that interested in anything that much that I want to put that sort of inquiry into it. So, but you know, it was just, you know, I was at MIT. I didn't know people in Boston. So I would do this thing. And I was, you know, the background is I was always interested in food. You know, I had something of a connoisseur grandfather who was in the food business.
Well, you mentioned that because that's very important in terms of your bio.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly for future historians. It's certainly the earliest source of, you know,
your
predisposition
father's father. Was
he was the president, among other titles, of a family business of supermarkets, which, you know, started out as a stand selling peas in Philadelphia and the, you know, whatever, and built into a fairly large regional grocery chain called Penn Fruit, the Pennsylvania Fruit Company, which was in Philadelphia.
Wait,
and
your grandfather was Penn Fruit?
That's right.
All right, go ahead.
And it still gets me some traction.
Does it?
You know, I'll meet people whose father remembers Penn Fruit, or you know, the owner of the great Murray's Cheese Shop in New York.
Oh, right around the corner.
He came to me once. We started talking. He said, "You know what? When I was a kid, his family is in the supermarket business. When I was a kid, my dad would pile us in the car and drive to Philly to the Penn Fruits just to show. He would say, just to show how it was supposed to be done.
So it's in your blood, and it's
genetic. It's in my blood.
Yeah,
and it's genetic. Anyway, that was a fairly big localish regional grocery chain that, you know, lost out in along with other regional chains in price wars with A&P and the like in the 70s. And
yeah, but look what happened to A&P. Yeah. Right? You're not exactly...
Anyway. Sorry. Is this on? Anyway, so I was at MIT. And, you know, I fancied myself something of a connoisseur, a little bit of a dandy, and I would doll myself up and, you know, grab some Japanese novel, and it's in the original Japanese, which, you know, I could barely read, but it looked real good. And I would go to one or another fancy restaurant in and around Boston, you know, sit by myself, order a bottle of wine, and, you know, I would do this, you know, many nights of the week. And
really?
And, you know, it's not something you see, this sort of lone, dressed-up guy reading, you know, some incredibly pretentious novel in some foreign language.
Translated into Japanese.
Exactly, exactly. Like anybody would know what that was. But, and, you know, after a while you get notice. You know, people either say, oh, you know, what a charming young man, or what a jackass, or... But either way, you meet people. And I met chefs, and I met, you know, sommeliers, and I met, you know, wine importers, and I just fell in with that crowd. And then I was invited to one of these wine scouting trips to Italy with an importer, just to tag along. And it was stunning. It was just, it was life-changing. Literally, the first day we were there, we were having lunch in this magnificent restaurant, and the chef was...
And what, you know, where was it?
This was above a town called Lecco, which is on the eastern, if I recall, it's on the eastern shore of Lake Como in northern Italy.
Indeed.
Yeah, and just gorgeous. And the friend I was with, brother, was doing a stage. He was a young chef at the time, was doing a little brief internship at this very fancy restaurant. And the chef took us in and was buying us lunch, you know, this Michelin 2-star restaurant. And the food was just gorgeous, and just everything was from just the streams and the fields around the restaurant. And the people were so passionate, and the places were so beautiful, and the food was so wonderful. I just thought, you know, if I'm surrounded by these things.
This is an epiphanic
certainly was.
Moment.
Epiphanic?
I made up the first one. You made up the second one. You had an epiphany.
you know, I felt that if I was surrounded by these things and these people and these places, then, you know, how could I not be happy?
We're talking to Matt Rubiner, the master cheesemonger, and we're getting to that slowly but surely, right?
You told me to talk.
No, I want you to talk. No, I think you're doing a terrific job. Okay, so now what happened?
So now,
or as we say around here, so then what happened?
So then what happened? So then I had a decision to make. You know, it's clearly, based on this lunch, a career change needed to happen. But I had a reasonably cushy job, and I had several months left on an Air Force grant that was funding the whole thing. So I decided to continue with the job, make plans for the future, and then toy around with the food business. So,
no, wait. I just want to make something clear to everybody who's listening.
Yeah.
So now your sign could say, Matt Rubiner, cheesemonger, formerly warmonger.
Killing me.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Anyway, so I went back to the, you know, my office, and And I bought a few pallets of olive oil from a guy who was looking to move a couple pallets of olive oil. You know, I just wanted to try selling food. It didn't occur to me that this might be illegal, that this might be...
Oh, you mean you were doing this...
Yeah, back in the MIT office. Yeah, right out of my office. I wasn't hiding it. I mean, I had the stuff stacked up
right
by
on the
wall.
Sure.
And people would come in and buy it. And
virgin, extra virgin, super extra virgin.
Just extra virgin. Mm. And people would come in, and it was a good deal on good oil, and so I made a little money. And
these are the people who were coming in for the coffee. Oh, no, the coffee
was...
Yeah, that was the old place.
Yeah, I suffered some mild reprimands from the, you know, the administrative
director.
Of the, yeah, the MIT guys. Then I took it a step further. A buddy of mine let me know about a glut, a champagne glut, imagine, at the time.
Oh,
and so
okay.
The prices had plummeted.
And you made a good deal.
And so we bought many, many, many cases of champagne.
Was this also in the office at MIT?
Yeah, well, I knew that was probably against university policy. It turns out it was probably against state and federal and local laws as well. So we bought all the champagne and we sold cut-rate champagne out of the office. You know, I'm not really sure this is true, but I tell it anyway. You know, and I was severely reprimanded by the chair of the department as he hoisted his case on his shoulder and left shaking his fist at me. It's probably not actually true. Anyway, but then I started thinking hard about, well, if I'm going to be in the food business, what aspect of the food business am I going to be in? It had to be something that was going to hold my interest for my life. You know, it had to be something that I would love, but also something that I could, you know, research, just like, you know, my interest in military history or any other kind of academic pursuit, something that was a rich enough field, literally and figuratively, that would keep me satisfied. And I looked into the wine business, but, you know, I didn't want to work in a restaurant necessarily. I certainly wasn't going to be a chef. Importer seemed fun, but you couldn't just kind of step in and be a wine importer. And these days you sort of can, but back then you couldn't.
The Corleones did that.
They did,
well,
yeah, they did. Yeah, among other businesses.
Yeah.
Because if they just had to survive on olive oil imports.
Yeah.
And then I met or had an arranged meeting with the owner of a up-and-coming cheese shop in Cambridge. And I thought, you know, this might be the way to go. Cheese is, you know, it's like wine in its complexity. And it's something that I could look at from so many different angles, you know, the various...
With cows and goats.
Well, but there's cows, goats, and sheep, and what that brings to cheese. You know, there's history, there's tradition, there's chemistry, biology. You can even look at it from a military science perspective in a way. You know, it's just the... Yeah, well, I'll give you just an example.
Sure.
You know, we think of goat's cheese as quintessentially French, you know, chèvre. But goats are a relatively recent, you know, say 1,000 years or so, but recent introduction into Europe. And they're really more of a Middle Eastern, you know, North African. And many of the goat cheeses that, you know, the French goat cheeses, Chablis, for instance, are that word sounds so French, but it's actually a corruption of an Arabic word for, you know, goat. And so the history of conquest as it shaped Europe also shaped traditions and ways of eating and you know kind of brought goats and their cheese and anyway, but I thought that was something that I could do for a lifetime, and so I took a job at this cheese shop for $6 an hour, which was then minimum wage, and I think the owner kind of tested me. Well, is this guy serious? You know, does he really want to do the work that it's going to take? So let's see if it'll work for $6 an hour. And I left my my little garret in Beacon Hill where I was living and moved in with a bunch of med students. And that was it. So then I was in the cheese business.
And you were learning every moment.
I was learning every moment. It was very much an apprenticeship. And the owner of the place took it very seriously. And this was just when the cheese business was beginning to move forward. You know, the state of the art then compared to now is very, very different in terms of the cheeses that are imported, the general kind of understanding of the market of cheese and appreciation, and then the American cheese industry, which then was a few cheeses of note and many, many of no particular note. But now it's a very thriving, very high-quality business. So I learned, and he sent me off to England for apprenticeships and to France.
Really? Even at the $6 an hour?
Yeah, well,
by that time,
I moved up rapidly from that rate. But
did he know you were, you know, basically on the make and were going to start your own career in cheese?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I'm in this business now, and I would love to hire people who are on the make and really wanted to, and I do. You know, we call an opening level position at our store an apprenticeship. Because we consider what we do a trade, and when you start a trade, you're an apprentice, and you know nothing makes me prouder than when somebody with great eagerness and passion works for me, and then moves on to start their own thing.
Across the street.
Well, preferably not across the street.
No.
But, you know, go to the city, work in a cheese shop, sure. start a cheese shop. And in fact, there was an article written on this in the Globe not that long ago, but this particular cheese shop at one point had 16 former cheesemongers. This is Formaggio Kitchen in Cambridge.
Wow.
16 former cheesemongers who had started their own cheese shops, which he has to be, you know, the owner had to be pretty proud of.
Is this Formaggio, did you say?
Formaggio Kitchen it was called, yeah, in West Cambridge. Anyway, so I worked there for years and got involved in every different aspect of the business, from, you know, obviously handling the cheese and selling the cheese and cutting the cheese, if you like,
sure,
and importing in the early stages of internet sales. And 6 years there did not dampen my passion for it.
But by this time, you were cheese boy.
Oh, yeah, I was cheese boy pretty quick. Well, the thing I did to become cheese boy, I don't think I put this in my detailed notes, but one thing I did to become cheese boy, you know, I wanted to get cheeses into restaurants. You know, there was a guy in New York who's still there and still very well known in the business, Max McCallman, who had a very groundbreaking, at least for this country, very traditional in Europe, but very groundbreaking cheese program at the restaurant called Picholin in New York. And I was on a panel with him at the American Cheese Society conference many years ago, and I was so impressed with his work getting cheeses into restaurants, I thought,
Wait. By what? This time you had moved all the way up to the fact that you were on prestigious panels with guys like this?
This particular prestigious panel, although I was on many subsequent prestigious panels, this was a panel I was on because my boss really wanted to watch a football game and with no notice informed the organizers that
kid,
I will be taking
get up
his
there.
Place on
yeah.
it. That's actually true.
Okay, so you're on the panel with a guy.
So I'm on the panel with a guy, and we're talking about cheese in restaurants. And so I went back and decided I'm going to have cheese in every restaurant table in Boston. And we made some real, real headway. And what I would do is, you know, I didn't have a car, but I had this barber coat. I still have one, you know, one of these English kind of hunting coats with various lined pockets where you put your grouse after shooting it and so forth. And I had one of these coats with all these little pockets, and I would stuff it with cheese, and I would go to a restaurant, order a cocktail at the bar, and then send, you know, pull out a
like the
wedge
guy in the
of
Milton
something.
Berle show. You know, remember he used to open
precisely.
Up his coat?
Well, yeah, I don't, yeah. of course, remember yeah. the Milton Berle show, but...
Yeah. Want to buy a watch? Want to buy a cheese?
And I would take out a cheese and send it back to the chef. You know, this is something very new for American restaurants, and they would come out, oh my God, where'd you get this? This is incredible. And so more and more we'd get, you know, different accounts, and people don't remember people's names, and so they all just started independently calling me Cheese Boy. It's like, oh, Cheese Boy's here. Let's see what he's got. The Globe once The Globe once wrote an article specifically about my cheese ripening coat.
About the coat, the barber coat you said?
The cheese ripening coat, yeah.
Why a barber coat? I don't get that.
Well, I was wearing the barber coat anyway. I didn't buy it just to ripen cheese in it, but it had many convenient
pockets.
It was a hunting jacket.
It had pockets.
It had lined pockets is
yes.
key.
Okay, gotcha.
You know,
gotcha.
So the grouse,
it would not pass the Department of Health
seep into
inspection process now, but those.
No, for dairy transport, no. It's a dairy transport and holding. It's probably not code.
No, not code. Okay, so now what happened then?
So I worked there for 6 years, and I think probably the boss realized finally after 6 years that I was on the make and, you know, was a small pond and, you know, two fishes, one increasing in size and the other one actually owning the pond. So
So one day he called you in.
No, he didn't even call me in. He literally
fired you.
Well, I mean, bodily threw me from the premises.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, quite literally. Yeah,
the thing I love about you,
for
Matt
passersby.
The thing I love about you, Matt Rubiner, is that you you have real strong feelings about just about everything.
Well,
you do. You have strong feelings, and sometimes
weak feelings.
You have the ability to, you know, take people on or alienate them because of your strong feelings, right? I mean, that's who you are. Now, by this time,
we're in that club together.
Who, me? By that time, you had hooked up with your wife or not?
I had hooked up in the modern parlance with my wife, yes.
Well, I mean, you know, you started to
We met in 97, and we were together, living together. And so I left there or was compelled to leave there in 2000.
Right.
I knew that I wanted to...
Now we're getting close.
So, you know, I still love this business. I was a little burnt out on retail for the moment, but I thought, okay, I'll consult, I'll import, I'll do something. And I was consulting to different businesses And I was also very active at the time, not so much anymore, in an organization called Slow Food, which still very much exists. And there was so much, and I say was because some of it has sort of fallen apart a little bit, but there was so much groundbreaking work done, for instance, in the preservation of heritage breeds or the farm animals or conservation of seeds, things like that, going on in the Berkshires at the time.
Right.
I would lead these groups of, you know, Bostonian members of Slow Food out to the Berkshires to visit these places and meet with the farmers. And also I was doing some consulting work for an importer who just happened to be headquartered in Dutchess County that would take me through the Berkshires. And I kept finding myself in the Berkshires and thinking, what a wonderful place to retire. But I was out here and I ran into a couple who had opened a cafe out here, and they were old catering customers of mine, coincidentally, and their chef was an old buddy of mine from Boston, worked in restaurants in Boston.
So who is this?
Well, the two women were Elise Etling and Lauren Joy. I don't know if they're around much, but they had a cafe in Richmond called Amano.
Uh-huh. Now, Richmond, for those people who are listening, is known for a number of things, one of which is that our governor has a house
there.
That's
right, yeah.
But also, he didn't then, but also being very picturesque, very beautiful,
and
been an important part of the Berkshires, but not a thriving commerce hub.
No, in fact, it's one of the few towns I remember at the time that the population has declined in Richmond since the Revolution. But it wasn't as, the Globe wrote an article on the store.
What store?
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. All right, so they have this cafe. There's a guy, Tom Tenuta, who's the chef, who he now owns Soma Catering, and which is in that same building in Richmond anyway. And we became friendly with them, and they had a good deal of money. And they invited me out eventually to turn the empty storefront. It was the old general store, Richmond General Store, that was above their cafe that they used really only for storage, invited me out to, you know, open a business. And so I went back to the then fiance, now wife, and said, you know, hey,
Alex, what do you got?
or how would you like to give up your promising career and or move from Cambridge to Richmond to follow my dream of opening a cheese shop? And she said, you know, sure, what the hell? And so we moved out. And
her career, by the way, for those who are listening, was a very impressive one in fashion.
Well, she would bristle at calling it fashion. You know,
she's otherwise known as sweaters.
Well, she's a sweater designer. She's a textile designer textile. You know, she went to college and got a degree in hand weaving, and she was a textile designer by training. And now she's a sweater designer by career. And
my wife tells me she's very important.
Yeah, she's ordered me not to discuss her in any detail on the radio.
Done.
Except
she's very important.
Right. I have a stock expression I was allowed to use. She leads the sweater design team at Eileen Fisher, which many of your listeners,
sure,
I hope, will know. Anyway, that's all I'm allowed to say on that.
Done.
So we moved out. We bought a house in Great Barrington. We opened this store, which was called—
In Richmond.
Our house is in Great Barrington.
Yeah.
We opened the store in Richmond, the Richmond store, and got married all in a couple of months, which was nuts. Yeah, so we opened the Richmond store. The Globe wrote, because it was in this old general store building, and you know, it was a whatever you want to call it. I mean, it was a store that sold artisan cheeses and groceries, and you know, call it fancy, call it gourmet, whatever you want. But it was in this, you know, this was the only real kind of commercial business in Richmond, except for a stone cutter and this and that, and people would walk in, kind of not knowing what it was, like, oh, goodness.
Look what we found.
And yeah. The Globe called it the Brigadoon of country stores, you know, referring to that great old musical about the little Scottish village in the heather
that nobody knew was there.
And nobody knew was there. And then as I like to say, but like that magical village, it, you know, disappeared very quickly. So I did that for a couple of years. It wasn't a terribly fruitful is the wrong word, but it wasn't a terribly, it wasn't a very good partnership with my then partner. So I left there after a couple years and then was able to lease and later acquire the space where I'm in now on Main Street in Great Barrington.
Okay. Now, for those of you who haven't been to Rubiner's Cheese Shop or to Ruby's around the corner, which is a sort of coffee and sandwiches, wonderful sandwiches and stuff. It is an extraordinary building. It was once a toy museum, I believe, or was supposed to be. Yeah, and it wasn't. And then it became kind of minimized, and you bought the first floor, which goes all the way through. You know, there was the French lady. Was it the French lady who owns the second floor?
There's nobody French in the building, to my knowledge.
Well, maybe that's right. And a third floor by another great guy, Eric. Yeah. So now you own this place.
Yep.
It's filled with great cheeses and the rest of it.
Yep.
And people come in, and it's really an interesting trade. You get Connecticut license plates, you know, the swells from Connecticut.
Not just swells.
No, but not just swells, but a lot of swells come up. And people who
We have local swells as well.
Yeah,
they don't have
right.
to come
no,
up.
No. I'm just telling you, people come from all over the place. You know, don't get so angry. No offense meant. Okay. So these people are now coming.
I'm defending the swells.
You're doing very well.
Swells.
I once came in there and I said, can I have some no-fat cheese? And you told me basically, forget it. You know, we don't do low-fat cheeses.
Still pissed about that.
Yeah, that's right. We don't do that here. And I knew right away.
I'm sure I made some wry comment.
Yeah, I knew right away that I was up against it. Right. And I learned that I wasn't getting that there. So then you have all of these cheeses. Now, help us out. I don't know anything about cheeses. What should I know?
That depends on how deeply you want to go into it. But, you know, as a...
Well, what's rudimentary?
Well, most rudimentary is... Cheese is preserved milk. You know, I mean, that really is why we make cheese, to preserve milk, ultimately. You know, milk is the primary sustenance of, you know, we mammals in our infancy, and odd among mammals, we humans insist on, you know, consuming it through our lives in various forms. But it's particularly prone to spoilage, as everybody knows. Although, much to my wife's irritation, soon into this profession, I lost the ability to identify sour milk. It just got better and better. It hasn't gone bad, dear. It's just different.
I don't get it.
Yeah, it's sour milk. I'll go into the fridge, like, you know, and smell the cream, and I'll say, it's complex. It's, you know, interesting. It's, it has a certain ripened character to it, and I'd pour it in my wife's coffee. She's like, what are you doing? This milk's sour. It's like, oh, it's not sour, dear.
It would curdle, wouldn't it, in the coffee?
So? Uh-huh. That's cheese.
That's cheese
well,
at that
it's
point?
Not exactly cheese, no.
Okay, but you only have 16 minutes to tell us all about cheese.
So, milk is particularly prone to spoilage, mostly water, fat in it. It takes on, it spoils easily. It's very difficult to transport. So it's not a very, you know, efficient source of nutrition, especially before, you know, refrigeration and bulk transport and so forth. So, you know, somewhere along the line, and there's all sorts of apocryphal stories, much of which are probably false, about the probably accidental conversion of that milk into cheese or, you know, other fermented milk products, yogurt, kefir, things like that. And then over the, you know, many thousands of years, the science behind it became better understood and more readily harnessed and refined and became cheese. But ultimately, cheese is preserved milk. And how does one preserve things? You know, a common way to preserve things is to get the moisture out of it. And the way cheese is made, you're essentially mimicking what goes on in the stomach of one of the stomachs of a cow, and distilling out from the milk its nutrients, the fats, the minerals, the other solids, and expelling the whey, the water, the waste product, and then taking that coagulated substance of the milk and further preparing it for aging, depending on how long you want to keep it around.
How do you do that?
I mean, it's reasonably complex and, you know, even at times more complex than science can really, adequately explain. But essentially, there's variations, endless variations, everything I'll say. But you add to the milk something that will cause this reaction of separating the curds in the whey. You know, often it's a substance called, an enzyme called renin, which is derived from the fourth stomach of a suckling ruminant animal. Anyway. And you're left with a curd, and then you have a number of ways at your disposal to help rid it of more moisture. Meanwhile, there's bacteria that you've added or that are existing naturally in the milk, have begun to eat the sugars in the milk and transform the milk, and the acidity will go up, and that will have some preserving aspects as well. But then it'll form this curd, this sort of custard, and you can drain some whey off of that, and that'll make, you know, set it up for the next step. You can cut the curd, depending how large you cut. If you cut it the size of a walnut, you know, literally by dragging knives through it, if you cut it more or less the size of a little floppy cube the size of a walnut, it'll yield a very moist cheese like a brie. If you cut into very fine rice-sized grains, it'll yield a cheddar or parmigiano. Anyway, I'm going to go down some path I can't get off.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Then, and as you cut it, you exponentially increase the surface area of it, more drains off, then you can drain it further. You can warm the curds, which will expel more of the whey and also cause the curds to kind of knit together and begin to take some form. You can drain it in certain molds, perforated molds. In fact, the word formaggio in Italian or fromage in French comes from the word for the mold. Same English word as form. You can press it to expel more whey, salt it, which you do for a number of reasons, but that helps preserve it. And you can age it, you know, and every step along the way depends on what cheese you've decided to make and why do you make the cheese you decided to make. You know, you made a goat cheese because, I mean, traditionally not so much in this country, but you made a goat cheese because you lived in a place where the available milk-giving animal was a goat. That place was also probably a hot place, so you weren't going to make something that would, you know, because this is before refrigeration, you're not going to make something that you have to keep around for very long. So you make something very moist and simple and fresh, and you get things like, you know, very fresh goat cheeses or fetas or, but really all boils down to preserving milk. And it's become, you know, very much of a great art. I mean, has become, you know, over thousands of years.
Have you ever made cheese?
You know, I've assisted in the making of cheese. You know, I very much think of myself as a, I don't want to overstate it, but think of myself as an art dealer as opposed to an artist.
Sure.
You know, it's that's not my bent. You know, my bent is finding what is great out of there and giving it a place in the market and caring for it while it's there.
Let me pursue that for a moment. What is the most expensive cheese in Rubner's cheese shop?
Well, you know, I mean, this goes back to the swells thing. You know, the let me be defensive for a second. Things are expensive because they're expensive.
Sure.
They're expensive to make. They're expensive to transport. And they don't make any sense unless they provide an income for everybody along the way. You know, so much of sustainability is economics. You know, if a farmer can't make money making cheese, why is he going to make cheese? It's not sustainable. There are some cheeses that will sell and often when they're this expensive, we won't even charge a normal markup because they'll just never sell. But we have cheeses that should be in the $50 to $60
a pound
range. And that's a very rare thing.
Name one.
Let's see. There's a cheese called Old Ford from a little farm in Bath in England, a goat's milk cheese made on a tiny, tiny scale. She only lets out a couple dozen wheels.
And you,
so very few places around the world are going to get these.
But you get them.
But I get them occasionally when I get in there first and when they're available.
Do you have to go there to get them?
No, but I do order them directly from England. I mean, I would love to be able to dash off and get them, but there's something about having a small business in a small town that tends to chain you down pretty good.
But we have a pretty special small business in our town in that, you know, we have you.
You're very kind.
Well, that's to make up for making you defensive before.
But, you know, there's another cheese. There's a cheese called Pecorino di Fossa from a very wonderful cheese maker and ripener in southern Italy that I was lucky enough to visit. And this is a cheese that is buried in the earth for several months. And this was, you know, there was a time, the story always goes, there was a time in Italy, the time of the brigandage, you know, you can read about in novels about, you know, Napoli. And, you know, the countryside was a rough place and they would raid your farm and take what they took and grab your cheese. And also I think, you know, tax collectors and the landlord would do the same. So these were hidden, but underground in the pressure and the different temperatures, they transformed. And it's a difficult process. It's a time consuming process. And so that cheese ends up by the time it hits, you know, a Great Barrington retail shelf, it's, you know, in the 40 to 50, yeah, closer to 50 a pound. Right? There's a few, but you know, most of them are dramatically less expensive than that.
Is there great competition with a specialty store like yours? You go into some of the supermarkets, you see tons of cheese around. Is this not comparable to what you offer?
Well, certainly comparable in some ways. But, you know, this is what I was saying before about the state of the art. You know, when I started in this business, many of the cheeses that are at Price Chopper, say, or Big Y, or one of the larger grocery stores, that was a state of the art in many ways when I got in the business. But then, you know, as the market developed, as this cheesemonger trade was kind of reborn, as people traveled and learned more about European traditions and visited these places, and as the American cheese industry and, you know, the began to grow and in general, the people's understanding of food and their passion for food, you know, this is at the time of the Food Network starting, things like that, you know, it just became a thing where, you know, butchers and bartenders became, you know, the rock stars, you know, like chefs had been, and the state of the art changed. What sets us apart from some stores, not all there, I mean, there's people who do very, very good work, you know, both in our little community, of course, around the country. But what sets us apart, or what we want to set us apart, is that we are very much practitioners of this trade. We take that very seriously. And this trade is cheesemongering. You know, and this is a traditional trade with apprentices and journeymen and masters. And there are trade associations and there are certifications. And but, you know, cheese is, it's not something, you know, we cheesemongers always bristle when someone kind of hangs a shingle on their door and says, I'm a cheesemonger now. Because it's just not like that. You wouldn't do that if you were a plumber or electrician. You'd do some work first. And, you know, you're dealing with a very finicky, you know, very difficult to handle, perishable product that has a personality, has 1,000 personalities. And you need this understanding of it to select it, to find it, to care for it, and to present it to the customer. And that's a big part of it. And then the other big part of it is we really cherish and take very seriously this role as traditional merchant. And that means to me, you know, I find things and I bring them to market. And then I serve to, you know, in my role as a go-between from the producer to the consumer, you know, to shorten that distance. So if you can come in my store and taste an olive oil and it's some and listen to me or one of my staff tell the story while you taste it, and you know, if for just a moment, just for a split second, you're transported to some orchard in Tuscany, you know, then we've done our job. That's something that takes some time and some training and you know, a real dedication to the trade. So
you've talked to Matt Rubiner about certification. Yeah. Give us an example of a certification you have.
There's one that's kind of popular now. Actually, you know, now that I think of it, I personally do not have a certification. There's a certified cheesemongering professional. This is a nationally recognized certification that just started last year, and other senior cheesemongers and I are all debating whether or not to actually take this. You know, not necessarily in fear that we would fail it, but you know, more of the who are they to tell me who's a cheesemonger? But I am a cheese judge. There's not an actual certification, but I'm a cheese judge for the American Cheese Society. I do have one title. I was the inaugural champion of the first U.S. Cheesemongers Invitational Competition.
Whoa.
2010. And on the strength of that victory, which was, you know, I'm headed off to tour the place in the Loire Valley of France. I'm a finalist in the International Cheesemonger Competition, which will be held.
I don't get it. What are you doing in that competition?
You just do your job for an hour in front of a bunch of people, and then you do things like blindly, you know, identify cheeses. You have to cut, you know, discrete weights of cheese without the benefit of a scale. You have to prepare cheese plates and displays. You have to take, you know, written examinations. You have to select a cheese board and defend it to a panel of, you know, French judges.
And you've done this before?
I only did it twice. I did it the first year I won. The second year I came in fifth, a disappointing fifth, I might add. So we were invited to apply and was accepted to compete in the internationals, whatever that is.
Whoa. And very quickly, have around the corner, you started this coffee shop, Ruby's.
Yeah.
Why'd you do that?
We had to do it. We learned this when we were in Richmond. You know, we need to, look, Great Barrington's a vibrant place, but it's still very much a destination in a larger sense. And we just got to give people more reason to come there. You know, we can't expect that people are going to need, you know, that cheese on a Wednesday morning, you know, our store, that we have some very, very regular customers and we have weekend regulars, but it's not necessarily the sort of place that people are going to go every day. And we also needed a showcase for the products we sell in the store. You know, everything that we serve at Ruby's, our cafe, comes straight out of store stock. So,
by the way, I just want to interrupt just one second to say it's a wonderful place.
Oh, thank you.
I love
very
it.
Much. Yeah. Well, always a pleasure
Spend
to
a
see
lot
you
time.
There.
Yeah.
And then there's very practical reasons. You know, we have a meat case filled with salamis and hams and, you know, from, you know, Parma to the Ozarks. And that stuff's got to be real, real, real fresh and pristine.
Gotta move it.
And we got to move it. And, you know, the flow of customers doesn't always cooperate. So, you know, that stuff is when you have a sandwich in the cafe, that's coming straight out of our case. In fact, we design, if you want, sandwiches based on the meats we want to carry in the case. And so there's that flow of product back and forth that just keeps, you know, it's perfect and fresh for the cafe. It helps us keep the stocks pristine in the store. And it's, you know, look, the people need their coffee. And, you know, we used to have the store closed on Tuesdays and the cafe closed on Tuesday. And there was a, you know, people would just be pounding on the door. And, you know, everybody on the street knows you can't hook them, then pull it away for a day, find it somewhere else. So so we have, you know, the cafe is busy when the store is not. You know, the cafe does a really vibrant Monday morning business. I mean, the cafe, the store does not. You know, the cafe has a solid day on a Wednesday. The store does not. I mean, now, you know, and we've seen you there. We've opened the cafe at night. You know, we're trying to maximize, you know, hey, look, we own the place all the time. The cheese is rotting all the time. We're, you know, the fridges are running all the time. Let's try to be open as much as we can. So we've opened the cafe at night on Friday and Saturdays and do this oyster bar sort of thing. And yeah.
Well, Matt Rubiner, what a pleasure. I mean, I love your sense of humor. I love the fact that you've succeeded the way that you have. We're all very proud of you to have you in our little town of Great Barrington. And you've put us on the map in many ways. And we all thank you for everything that you're doing. It's terrific to try to match wits with you. It's almost impossible, though.
You're much too kind. It's my pleasure.
And it was great to talk to you. By the way, do you have a website?
We have, you know, the simplest of markers, but that's our current project. And but it's Rubiners.com.
Rubiners.com. Yeah. Is it taking an apostrophe?
No, I don't think they allow an apostrophe, so it's just the straight up S.
Great to talk to you.
It's my pleasure.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.